Okay, guys, I'm going to have to really put the pedal to the metal tonight because we're running. We don't have a lot of time. We're going to go through this chapter 10 in Genesis, all right? Now listen, this chapter 10 has been known as the Table of Nations, okay? This is basically where we're given an overview of where all the nations have sprung from or where they originated from, all right? And on the surface, it seems like a very, very, I think, dry, boring, bland kind of chapter, which, it's filled with these names that hardly anybody could pronounce. I mean, when I try to read these things, I feel like I've just washed my tongue and I can't do anything with it. But I nevertheless feel like, okay, this is God's Word, and I try to read every single word, even if I make a fool of myself trying to pronounce it. I still try to do it because I want to know that, hey, I've read every single word over and over and over again in the Scriptures because the Holy Spirit put it there for a very specific reason. And so I don't like to just, skip over something simply because on the surface it may not seem to be that important. But and when reading this Table of Nations, I think it has a tremendous significance in a lot of different ways. All right, I'm not going to read the whole chapter. I'm just going to read portions of it, then break it down as we go along, okay? And like I said, for the sake of time, because of the time constraints that we have, because we got started so late, I'm going to really try to make this brief if I can. But anyway, just before we get started too, I also wanted to make mention of the fact that I have a lot of these different maps and these different charts that I've gone through the trouble of enlarging and putting up here. And so I'm going to be kind of getting up and down. So anybody that may be listening to this on the internet, it's just simply if there's a fluctuation in my voice or the sound, it's simply because I'm up and down pointing to these different charts. And I know you can't see them on the internet, but nevertheless, I'll try to explain what's going on as much as I can. Beginning with verse 1 in chapter 10, it says, "Now these are the records of the generations of Shem, Ham, Japheth, and the sons of Noah, and the sons who were born to them after the flood." Now remember, these are the three sons that Noah had. I don't know if he had any more sons after Noah, after the Noahian flood. It doesn't say that he did or did. Apparently, these were the only three sons that he did have. Okay, and from these three sons of his, really sprang forth all the different nations, all the different nationalities and languages and tongues that we have today. And so he begins with his son Japheth, as far as his descendants are concerned. Now, apparently, if you read the genealogy, Shem was the firstborn. And I believe Ham was the secondborn, if I'm not mistaken. At least the order that we see in previous chapters. And that Japheth was the youngest, okay? So, but they mixed the order around here, and I think he does it for a very specific reason. Because when he gets to Shem, who is the oldest, he puts him last in this particular genealogy, simply because it's through the line of Shem that Christ comes, okay? And that's what these genealogies are really basically for. But it does give us a great deal of information in between the lines, all right? So it says here in verse 1, "Now these are the records of generations of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the sons of Noah, and the sons who were born to them after the flood. The sons of Japheth were Gomer and Magog and Madai and Javan and Tubah and Meshech and Tirus. And the sons of Gomer were Ashkenaz and Riph, and Togarma. And the sons of Javan were Elisha and Tarshish and Kittim and Dodrim. And from these the coastlands of the nations were separated into their lands, every one according to his language and according to their families and into their nations." Okay, now he just gave us an overview as far as the descendants of Japheth were concerned. Now we know, we can trace these back, okay, through various genealogies and various history books and various resources, that Japheth was really the patriarch or the father of a lot of these different nations that have sprung up across Europe, or actually around Russia in this area right in here. Let me just give you an example here. Okay, now he's talking about Japheth. Now in Japheth, actually, if you look at this map here, he's really basically the father of the modern-day Russians, the modern-day Germans, the Poles, the Hungarians, Romanians, the Yugoslavians, the Spanish. All of these different nations that comprise basically most of Europe and a lot of Russia, and a lot of the peoples of along the Black Sea, along the sea coast of the Caspian Sea, right around in those areas there. These are the ones that basically migrated around the area that we know today as Europe and Russia. Okay, now the various names that he's given us here, I think that some of them even crop up other places in Scripture, especially in Ezekiel, as a matter of fact, even in Revelation, when he talks about Meshach and Tubla and Gomer and Togarmah and these various peoples. These are the ones that we are told that in the last days through Ezekiel that he's going to use Russia as basically their leader, who is going to lead these various nations, these various hordes of people down in a conflict with Israel right at the very beginning of the tribulation period. Okay, I say it's at the beginning. Some people think it's mid-tribulation. Some people think it's right at the very end. They think it's Armageddon. But I think if you really look at it closely in the light of all Scripture, that it's actually these are the Russian people who are going to lead a lot of these other Japheth's descendants down against Israel, well, actually for their Waterloo. Okay, at the very beginning of the tribulation period, where John tells us in Revelation that a quarter of mankind will be wiped out by the sword. And that's at the very beginning of the tribulation period. Okay, not at the end. But I just want to bring this out to you as far as, you know, when he talks about Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan. Gomer is actually, he became the father of the Celtic nations. Magog became basically the father, the patriarch of all the Russian people. Madai became the father of the Meds, and Javan became the father of the Greeks and the Syrians. And Tubla became the father of all those people who migrated south of the Black Sea and to Spain, and Meshach also includes Russia and Tyrus as the Traconians. So, and then it just goes all the way down the line from there, okay? So when you look at the descendants of Japheth, just kind of think in your mind, you know, all of these nations in terms of like Yugoslavia and Poland and Russia, those are the type of Slavic people that have descended from Noah, from his son Japheth, okay? Now, if you look at his other son that he mentions here, and I'm going to back up there and just elaborate on a little bit more in just a second here, but it says here in that verse 6, it says, "Now the sons of Ham were Cush." Now, why don't you keep something in mind here? Remember when we read last Thursday night that Ham saw his father Noah in a drunken stupor, and I guess he was laying naked in his tent. He had uncovered himself in his drunken stupor, and apparently Ham, his second son, well, he told his other brothers about their father in a very derogatory way, I guess a very humiliating way. And I believe, now this is suggested because we're not given a lot of detail here, I believe that Ham's son, Cana, had something to do with this. In other words, it may have been Cana who pointed out, "Hey, look at Grandpa, he's in the tent there, he's naked, and he's made a complete fool of himself." And anyway, you know, his son, Ham, rather than showing respect for his father and showing consideration, he actually tried to expose his weakened condition, all right? But his other two sons, Japheth and Shem, they took a cloak and they backed up and they wouldn't even look at their father and they covered him up. And so when Noah woke from his drunken stupor, he knew what had happened to him and he actually cursed the descendants of Cain. He didn't curse Ham. Ham was the one who was primarily responsible, but he said, "Cursed be Cana." Now, Ham had he had a number of sons, but it was Cana who he cursed. So why did he curse Cana? We are not told. But I think Cana had something to do with exposing, you know, the weakness or the failure or the sinfulness of his grandfather. And that's why Cana ended up being cursed. Now, I know that, you know, the Mormons and other people throughout various church history have always said that, well, the curse was that the Canaanites were black. And that's just absolutely not true. Ham did become the father of the black race, but it wasn't through Cana. It was Cana that was cursed and his descendants, and not the black people. Okay, so some people have used this as, I think, sometimes a springboard for their prejudice, for their racist, or, you know, ideas, or they've even used it to justify slavery, because they've used this quote before, thinking, well, okay, the descendants of Cana, descendants of Ham through Cana were black. Well, that's just not true. The black people actually came through Ham's son, Cush. We know that because they are the ones that settled in northern Africa. But I just wanted to give you that overview because it says in that verse 6, the sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Cana. Now see, he had four different sons here. Cush actually became the father of the black race. Okay? It wasn't Cana. It was Cush. And Mizraim became the father of most of the Egyptians today. And Put actually became the father of modern-day Libya, or a lot of the Libyans today. Okay, and then Cana, he became the father of the Jebusites and the Amorites and the Geshurites and the Hivites and the Arkites and the Sinites and the Adverites and the Semarites and the Hamathites. In other words, we're going to read that in just a second, but what's interesting to me is these are the ones that we are told that settled in Israel before the Israelites got there, before God delivered them from Egypt, delivered them from Pharaoh, and brought them into the Promised Land. Well, the Promised Land was inhabited by all the Canaanites. Okay, that's why it was called the land of Cana. And they were the ones that were cursed. You will not find a Canaanite today. You will not find a Jebusite or an Amorite or a Geshurite or a Hittite or any of these others, because they have been destroyed by God's people because of their sinfulness. But this all came down through the curse. In verse 6 it says, the sons of Ham are Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Cana. And the sons of Cush were Sheba, Havilah, Sabath, and Ramah, and Septica, and the sons of Ramah were Sheba and Dedan. Okay, now these were the sons of Cush, and most of these descendants you will find around northern Africa. And then it says here that now Cush became the father of Nimrod. He became a mighty one on the earth, and he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calneh, and the land in the land of Shinar. And from that he went forth into Assyria, and built Nineveh, and Rehoboth-ir, and Calah. And Rezin between Nineveh and Calah, that is the great city. Now, keep a couple things in mind, okay? It mentions here a descendant of Cush. He said his name was Nimrod. Now, it says he became a mighty one on the earth that was a great hunter before the Lord. Now, what it means by that, I don't really know. I don't think any commentator really knows exactly what it's referring to. But if we take what we are given here as far as the information, as far as Cush and Nimrod, and we couple it with the information that we're going to be reading in our, the following chapter, what we see is that Nimrod actually became the first king on earth. He became the first king of mankind. Mankind had populated to such an extent that now he became a great hunter. In other words, he was a great politician. He was had a great following. He had a number of people who were behind him as far as his leadership was concerned. And he was trying to galvanize all the people on the earth at that particular time under his rule. Okay? And what he wanted to do what he wanted to do is, rather than have people spread abroad, he wanted them under his domain. So he proposed building this big, huge tower that would extend into heaven. And I think one of the purposes of the tower was to simply, you know, chart the stars and get control over people through, you know, the future or whatever. Okay, I don't think it's referring to here he was a mighty hunter before the Lord as far as animals are concerned, but it could be, but it has a much deeper meaning. In other words, a lot of tribes throughout history, okay, if you were a great hunter, you usually became chief of your tribe, all right? Well, I think that's what it means. That this guy is very skilled in a lot of ways, and I think it goes much deeper than simply being a hunter. I think what it is that he was a real politician. He was a real leader. He knew how to motivate people, how to delegate authority, how to get people enthused, because he started a massive project, okay, in which he involved all the known world at one particular time, who were all in one under one language. Okay, so I believe what it simply means is that Nimrod became the first king the world had ever seen, had ever known. Okay, and he was very, very aware of the fact that if people dispersed across the continents, across the land, that he would no longer have control over them. So when we get into next week's chapter, or actually the next chapter, when we deal with the Tower of Babel, we'll see that his intention was to galvanize these people with one massive big project and to keep control over them. So, and he was a descendant of Ham. And so you see here in a situation, well, Cana was going to be accursed and he was going to be a servant to his brother. But here Nimrod actually became the first king, and he was a descendant of Cush, okay? And so when it says here,
Verse 8, now when Cush became the father of Nimrod, he became a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. That phrase, before the Lord, I think what it means simply is that in God's eyes, he became a very powerful man in the eyes of God. Okay? But that he was not a godly man, we know that because when he instigated having this Tower of Babel built, it was an affront to God. And God cursed the people because of it and for it. Okay? So, what we're told here is that it says here in our verse not 10, it says, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. That's where it started. That was the beginning. Okay? That's when they were all one language. That was where he galvanized everybody to build this huge, massive ziggurat, or this big, huge tower, you know, to lead into heaven, to actually chart the movement of the stars and, to try to predict the future and these type of things. Well, it says here, and not just Babel, but also Erech and Akkad and the Calnea in the land of Shinar. In other words, right around the land of Babylon. I don't have that particular map out right now, but it was around that region. That is the cradle of civilization. That is where mankind was actually, not only was, I believe, around that particular area was the Garden of Eden, but even after the flood, that's where mankind and the cradle of civilization really began. And it began in the land of Shinar. And the land of Shinar is simply, it points to the land of Babylon. That's where it all began. But then look what it says here after that. He says, from that land he went forth into Assyria and built Nineveh and Rehoboth and Calah. In other words, once the languages were confounded, then he led whatever people could understand him into the land of Assyria. And there he built some other cities. But now he didn't have the whole earth following after him. Only those who could understand his language. So you see what it's saying there? He started out in Babylon, okay, and then because of the curse that he brought down upon the world, that God confounded the language, now he was forced to move out of Babylon, Babel, okay, and find another kingdom. So he moved north to Assyria.
He abandoned it.
And he moved north to Assyria and then built the city of Nineveh. Nineveh is one of the oldest cities, one of the first and oldest cities known to man. Anyway, then it says in verse 13, and Mizraim became the father of Ludim and Ananim and Lebabim and Naphtalim and Parsium and Carlusium, from which came the Philistines and Kaphtorim. Okay, now Mizraim, these different names here, Mizraim, I believe, is actually, he became the father of the Egyptians, he became the father of the Philistines, he became the father of the of some of these various other nationalities, okay? And he, his father, of course, was Ham. And then it gets into Cana. Now here's where, you know, I really want to emphasize that here's the Canaan descendants, okay? And they are, it says, he became the father of Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth. And the Jezebite and the Amorite and the Geshurite and the Hivite and the Arkite and the Sinite and the Arvadite and the Semorite and the Hamathite. And afterwards, the families of the Canaanites were spread abroad. And the territory of the Canaanites extended from Sidon. You go towards Gera as far as Gaza, and you go towards Sodom and Gomorrah and Adam and Zeboiim as far as Laisha. Now, what it's saying here is basically the Canaanites actually inhabited, if you look at this map here, they actually occupied about a 200-mile long stretch along the coast, and they were occupied up as far north as Sidon and as far south as the end of the Dead Sea. So they occupied basically the entire promised land, all right? And they lived there for centuries before God finally threw them out, okay, because of their wickedness and because of their sinfulness, when he brought his own people in there to give them that land, all right? That's where this curse comes in, and that's where the Canaanite descendants, settled. But today, you're not going to find a Jebusite. You're not going to find an Ammonite. David wiped them all out. David either wiped them all out or subjugated them, okay, when their time of punishment had come. All right? And
And so then he says here in that verse 20, these are the sons of Ham according to their families and according to their languages, by their lands and by their nations. And also to Shem, the father of all the children of Eber and the older brother of Japheth, children were born. Now we're getting into the line of Shem, and it's very important that we keep an eye on the line of Shem, because from the line of Shem, we can follow and trace Jesus' genealogy, all right? So it says in verse 22, the sons of Shem were Elam and Asher and Arpachshad and Lud and Aram, A-M. And the sons of Aram were Uz and Hul and Gether and Mash. And Arpachshad became the father of Shelah, and Shelah became the father of Eber. And the two were born to Eber, and the names of one was Peleg, for in his day the earth was divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. And Joktan became the father of Almaldad, and Shelef, and Hazarmath, and Jerah, and Hadoram, and Uzal, and Dikah, and Obal, and Abimael, and Sheba, and Ophir, and Havilah, and Joab, and all these were the sons of Joktan. Now their settlement extended from Mesha as you go towards Sephar, the hill country of the east. These are the sons of Shem, according to their families, according to their languages, by their lands, according to their nations. These are the families, the sons of Noah, according to their genealogies, by their nations. And out of these, the nations were separated on the earth after the flood. Now, he gives us all the different names of the descendants of Shem. Now, keep a couple things in mind. Shem became the father of many nations, in a sense. And if you follow the line of Shem, I put up a chart here. If you follow it all the way down, you'll follow it down to Abraham, all right? But Abraham, remember, he ended up becoming the father not only of the Jews, but he became the father of the Arabs as well, okay? And he ended up, through his concubine Hagar, ended up having his son Ishmael. And then Ishmael became the father of 12 princes, or 12 tribes, that are basically comprised of the modern-day Arab nations. So, in a sense, Abraham did become the father of the Jews and the father of the Arabs. And then some of these other descendants, if I'm not mistaken, they actually occupied most of Asia and Asia Minor and Indonesia. So they actually spread out all over the place, okay, as far as the descendants. But here's the thing that I wanted to emphasize before we close tonight, is that if you back up to this verse 25, it says something I think is very, very, very profound, and yet it's so typical of the way the Bible just understates things, okay? When I say understates things, in other words, it says things in such a way that it is, you would think that it would give us a lot more detail, a lot more information, a lot more emphasis. Instead, it just says it as a matter of fact and a matter of passing. And you're left there to wonder, what did he say? What did he mean? Look what he says here in that verse 25. And the two sons were born to Eber. The name of one was Peleg, and from his day the earth was divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. Now, it says the earth was divided in his particular day. Now, some people, and even some commentators or some Bible's translations figure that, well, the earth was divided, meaning that the languages were divided during his particular day. But I don't think that that's what it really is saying. Because I think if you take in consideration the Noachian flood, and in the Noachian flood, remember God said that the fountains of the deep broke open. Now, we know today that there's 50 times more water, fresh water, under the earth than there is fresh water on top of the earth. But before the Noachian flood, apparently there was a lot more water than that. And when it says the fountains of the deep broke open, they actually burst open in such a way that they actually divided the continents. And now this isn't just some crazy theory. I went to the library the other day, and I'm sure that most of us here have read about the continental drift, right? Now this is something that they've pretty well established as being fact, all right? But let me just read you a couple excerpts from the encyclopedia as far as continental drift is concerned. It says, once explorers returned to their home countries from their travels around the world and constructed global maps, people noticed that the spheres of the continents, particularly South America and Africa, appeared to fit together like pieces of a colossal jigsaw puzzle. Not until around the earlier 20th century did scientists propose that these continents fit together because they were joined in the distant past. The two Americans, Frank Taylor and Howard Baker, provided evidence that the Americas separated from Europe and Africa. However, Alfred Wegener, a German meteorologist, is generally credited with originating the continental drift theory, which states that all continents were once joined together in some supercontinent named Pangaea. That was the name of a supercontinent. In other words, the world was all one landmass at one time, but it drifted apart at one particular time in history. But according to the continental drift theory, okay, the ones who hold to that, and they say that there's plenty of evidence to support it, and there really is, they say it took 200 to 300 million years. Well, that's just not the case. But the fact is, if you look at this globe here, okay, if you look at this map, look at, once they put together a map, they said, hey, you know, this looks like a jigsaw puzzle that was once all put together. Especially if you look at Africa, how it could fit right snugly in between North America, South America. Okay, and you look at various these other portions here. Well, I don't know how many of you can see this, but this is what they call Pangaea. This real dark outline here was what they believed the Earth looked like at its original state. It was all one big, huge, massive land continent. All right, but after the flood, because of the fountains of the deep had broke open, it actually split these land masses. Okay, in different pieces, and the encyclopedia tells us that they actually drifted apart from one another, like massive glaciers. They just floated away from one another, and we know that it's possible because they know that the ocean floor, actually the entire world's crust, is only about 15 miles deep at the most, okay, at an average, but it floats on plates that are constantly moving, and they tell us today that. The continents are still moving. They say they move a few inches a year from one another. But right after the flood, it had caused such tremendous upheavals as far as the land was concerned, you know, that it actually split them in such a way that they drifted from one another. So that's what it's talking about here when it talks about the land or the earth being divided during this guy's particular Pele's day. Okay, so look at this. What we have today, instead of one big massive supercontinent, we've got seven different continents. We've got North America, South America, Australia, Antarctica, Africa, Europe, and Asia. And we can see how they all did separate. The only argument I have with the continental drift theory is that it didn't take 200 to 300 million years. It happened at a very, very rapid pace. All right? And it was a judgment from God. Once the languages were confounded and people began to spread across the supercontinent, the one big landmass, then the continents broke apart. Now, people used to laugh at this theory, but what they found here is that it fits all the data. In other words, they find mountain ranges that were connected. Not only that...
Would it fit together like a puzzle then?
Yeah.
Yeah,
see this very dark spot in here? This is the way it once looked. I got this out of an encyclopedia the other day. This is this one big supercontinent landmass. Okay, this was all one big massive supercontinent. All right, now it's divided into seven continents. All right, like I said, we got North America, South America, Australia, Antarctica, Africa, Europe, and Asia. I think another interesting thing is this. When you go to the book of Revelation, we read that about the beast having seven heads, 10 horns. We read about the dragon, which is Satan, that has 7 heads and 10 horns. And you wonder, what do 7 heads symbolize? Well, 7 is the number of totality. It's the number of perfection. It's the number of completeness. Well, if you take it in the symbolic sense, you will see that the beast or the Antichrist is represented in the scriptures as having 7 heads, and so is Satan, the dragon, because it means that they have complete and total control over the whole world, over these 7 different continents. All right, it was one big, huge supercontinent, but now it's divided into 7 different continents. All right, and like I said, if you look at this, You know, you can see how Australia fit up here, how this all fit together here, how it was one big landmass. And they've got it basically outlined here, okay, to show you how, you know, the world used to look. That's why I keep telling everybody, you know, when I'm going through the book of Genesis, especially when we're dealing with the Noachian flood, the world that we live in today looks absolutely nothing like the world that God created in its origin. Absolutely nothing like it. I mean, it's almost like we're living on the moon in comparison, and we're living in a very beautiful world, all right? But the way that God constructed the world, it had a vapor canopy around it, it protected it, it was like a hothouse effect, it didn't have any polar ice caps or anything like that. You had, you know, an even temperature all the way around the earth. Okay, everything was conducive to longevity and to long life and to actually large sizes, okay? Because of the way that everything was not only genetically programmed. I mean, man was genetically programmed to live forever. Okay? And that's why they had you could find people who could live almost 1,000 years. Okay? Not only because genetically they had the makeup to do that, but also because, you know, they had the environment that was conducive for it. But again, see how the judgments have you know, continued to escalate and continue to bring us further and further down this line as far as, kind of self-destruction. I don't know how else to put it other than if you look at how man started, you know, and it's God's original intent for man, and look at where we are at today. Not only are we all divided because of our languages, okay, that was a curse, but even the earth itself is all divided up, okay, as part of this curse. And, you know, it's only Jesus Christ that's going to be able to bring it all back together. And you take a look at all these different land masses. You take a look at the different nationalities, different languages, different people all throughout the world. And it's like there's no possible way that we could ever get it together. I don't care. You know, the United Nations, as far as I'm concerned, is the modern-day Tower of Babel. I mean, it is just what is it? All it is a building of confusion, mass confusion. They could not, you know, hit their own rear end with both hands. I mean, they just couldn't get anything done as far as world peace is concerned. Why? Because they've rejected the Prince of Peace. Okay? I remember reading a story about this retired rear admiral. He was shot down over Vietnam, and he was in the Hotel Hanoi, where he was a prisoner of war there, and they used to, you know, the American prisoners used to tap kind of Morse code back to one another, okay, and they would communicate to one another. And one time, one prisoner was able to slip this, rear admiral, this makeshift cross of bamboo. It was just a small, tiny cross, but it said it meant so much to him because he would use this cross to pray every day and pray every night and pray all the time. And he said that one day they were going through the camp, going through the prison, and they were, you know, having the prisoners get out of their cells because they were trying to seal up the ventilation shafts, you know, seal them up to the point where they could make sure that nobody could escape. And so the guard goes in there, and of course he tears up all of his possessions, which are very little, but he finds the cross, and he comes out smiling, he sees his cross, you know, and he tears it up, rips it to shreds, and throws it into an open sewer, you know, and this poor American POW was really infuriated, but he couldn't do anything about it, because that was his lifeline as far as, you know, he was concerned. And he said they had five or six very, very old, elderly people who they were using to seal up these ventilation shafts. So these old people go in there to seal this thing up, and they took him about a half an hour, and then they come out, and they lock him back in his room, and you know, he's shuffling through some of the stuff, and he ended up finding a brand new cross made out of broom straw, and it was almost like here you got two enemies. Okay, he felt like all North Vietnamese are the enemy. Okay, and he hated them with a passion, and he figured they all hated him too. But when these old people saw what happened to his cross, either all of them or one of them made him a cross and put it back. Now look at that. Here's two sworn enemies, and yet you see how the Prince of Peace can actually bring together these two people who couldn't even speak the same language, yet they connected with the cross, right? And how many times does that happen all over the world? That it's the only way that we're going to have peace on earth is when the Prince of Peace comes back to bring peace among the nations. See, this is all part of the curse. This world looks nothing like it did when God created it. Absolutely nothing. And we are in such a horrendous mess today. And it's all the effect of our rebellion against God and our sin against God and how it has had an escalating and compounding effect, hasn't it? To the point now where we're in a world that is just teetering on the brink of total destruction because it is so filled with hate and contempt and misunderstanding, right? And wars and divisions and even people of the same nationalities are at each other's throat. I mean, the only way that the world is going to be brought back into one, okay, and I'm not talking about as a continent, I'm talking about as a people, is through the Lord Jesus Christ, all right? So I just really wanted to bring this out because when it makes a statement that to me is such a profound understatement that simply says that during a particular man's lifetime, during Peleg's lifetime, the earth was divided. And, you know, when you read that, on the surface, you may think, well, that's when the language is confounded and people spread across. But that's not what happened. The languages were confounded first. The people then were forced to spread out. And then once they spread out, then the continents divided. Okay? So, you know, you had these people and you had all these animals that were on the various portions of the supercontinent that now were separated from one another. All right? I mean, to me, that's a profound statement, isn't it? And I'm just not making this as stating this as some kind of theory, because I think they have proven over and over and over again that the continental drift is an absolute fact. Okay, it is a theory, but they've been able to prove it, that the ocean floor actually has moved away from itself and these continents have separated. The only argument I have with them is their time frame. All right? Okay, does anybody have anything you want to add or anything you want to share?
Well,